And you made a comment earlier about like maybe the Meta Quest is more of like a gaming console or like a gaming device or something like that. I mean, you could look at it like that, but I obviously look at it as, it's a modality to consume content, right? And immersive content, that is, right? And I see a lot of different things going on. Like, for some people it's a gaming console, for some people it's fitness, for some people it's learning. It has a lot of different purposes and it has a lot of great capabilities as well. Like,
we're going through something absolutely historic.
Technologies across the board are growing exponentially.
It's a disruption that's going to completely redefine the way businesses compete.
In the next decade, we're going to lose 40% of today's Fortune 500 companies.
The exponential growth of computing is continuing.
AI is nowhere near its full potential.
Whether you like it or not, that the future cannot be stopped by anyone.
Hi there, everybody. This is Mark Rubenkov, and welcome to episode number 139 of the Future Tech and Foresight podcast. And today we're going to be reviewing one of my favorite podcast topics and technologies, which is virtual reality. And it touches on XR, and we get into a little bit of AR with regards to the Apple Vision Pro that was recently released. So I've been really interested in virtual reality for a few years now, mostly because it was kicked off during the pandemic, where many of you know I was stationed in Barcelona, set up in Barcelona, and because Spain had one of the most stringent lockdown policies in all of Europe, and I guess you could say all of the world, I had just recently bought the Meta Quest 1. And while all of my peers and friends were kind of stuck in their apartments, losing their minds a little bit, I was able to do some kind of meditations in some nice forests with, digital deer and rabbits and birds and trees, etc., all over the place. But also able to go to kind of different conferences during the pandemic, where I was able to interact with people at a much more high. I guess you could say high degree, more so than many of my peers and other people that were stuck in their apartments, stuck talking to their roommates. I was able to, kind of get out there, if you will, and have a little bit of a social life, though digital. And in the early version of the metaverse, it was still important to kind of keep my social skills continuing, if you will. So because of that, I've been really interested in virtual reality over the last couple of years, and I've had numerous guests onto the podcast to talk about virtual reality, augmented reality, extended reality in general, and kind of the different aspects of why it's important. Training has always been, learning training has always been a really big use case for virtual reality, and that is going to be the subject of today's discussion. So my guest, Tony Bevilacqua, who I'll introduce in a moment here, and we talk about obviously training and his company Cognitive 3D, specifically how the tracking and kind of the biometrics that can be taken, recorded from different kind of training scenarios can be used to improve training, why training is so beneficial within a virtual reality simulation. And we also get into one of my favorite discussions with regards to, well, any emerging technology, but virtual reality in particular, the future of work and how virtual reality, especially kind of this new, I don't know if it's necessarily a hype wave, but certainly a new or renewed level of interest and motivation with regards to virtual reality and augmented reality and the metaverse, due to Apple Vision Pro's release over the last week or so, how all of that kind of filters into the future of work and our ability to interact in immersive environments with team members now and in the coming years. And Tony is luckily enough part of a remote team, and they actually use VR technology to interact. I think he mentions at least one or two times a week, so we get to hear about that. And I think it's a apart from that just being interesting, I think it also is relevant and interesting because it kind of offers a glimpse into what I and many people are thinking of the future of work and how we're going to be working in more and more remote teams, and VR can be one of those tools and technologies that enables remote teams and enables remote teams to happen, but also that kind of immersion and team connectiveness to happen as time goes on. So it's a really interesting episode. Tony is very knowledgeable in the space, and I was more than happy to have him on as a guest. So who is Tony? Tony Bevilacqua is the founder and CEO of Cognitive 3D, a spatial analytics platform that gathers data from virtual and augmented reality experiences in new ways and then turns them into actionable insights. Specifically, Cognitive 3D helps companies measure human behavior within 3D simulations. Prior to founding Cognitive 3D, Tony co-founded and exited another startup that focused on revenue optimization and data analytics for enterprise customers. So we do get into the specifics of Cognitive 3D and the really interesting work that Tony is doing there. But the conversation does focus on, as I mentioned before, kind of how training is impacted and benefited from virtual reality technologies, the future of work, and kind of just training and learning in general as it regards to virtual reality. So I hope that you enjoy the discussion, the episode, that you get something from it as much as I did, especially if you're a kind of VR enthusiast. I think you'll get a lot out of this episode. So without further ado, we can get into the discussion. Thanks again. Great. Well, Tony, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast today to talk about what I mentioned beforehand, what is one of my favorite topics to discuss on the podcast, which is VR and AR and XR in general. So thanks a lot for coming on. I'm looking forward to getting into it with you today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mark.
Awesome. So why don't we start off with what initially got you interested in this really fascinating space? Was there kind of like a unique moment, or was it kind of a natural evolution, kind of organic growth?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of goes way back. Like I'm a second time founder. I ran a company prior to this called Kinetic. We had a, you know, kind of an analytics product that we had taken into the market, primarily in the gaming space. So in the, you know, kind of go to market of that product, I got a lot of exposure to the gaming industry, what was going on. And, you know, there's this guy named Palmer Luckey that was out there, and he had this thing called the DK1 and then eventually the DK2. And, you know, I got an opportunity to try it at one of the GDCs. I was building a product that was very similar to what was already in the market, you know, kind of the mobile analytics category, and realized pretty soon that, like, hey, this is an opportunity where we could actually, you know, build something innovative, something special, something that was unique, that answered a specific question or pain point that developers had, you know, in terms of how people are interacting with these new 3D immersive worlds. And so, you know, I was product lead at this prior company, and, you know, I felt like it was time for me to move on and go, you know, do something myself. And so I ended up founding Cognitive 3D in late 2015. We hired our first employee early 16, took a product to market in about mid 16 as well. So that was kind of like my earliest, you know, kind of view into all this stuff, as I was trying to build like really traditional tools for the mobile space. But then once you put that headset on, you start thinking about like what the art of the possible might look like in immersive technology. And it was like, okay, I'm gonna spend my time on this.
right. Yeah. I think, I mean, as I mentioned before the recording, like late 2019 was really the time for me that I started really getting interested in VR especially. And I was trying to bring people into the space, right? Like, look, this fascinating technology. And then, you know, what are all the future ramifications of it, which I love talking about with my peers and colleagues, et cetera. But you've been around in the space for a lot longer than that. So, you know, my dipping of toes into the space has only lasted about 4 years. You've been almost 10 years now. So how, maybe you could start us off with, how have you seen the evolution of the virtual reality space in particular?
I mean, it's evolved significantly, right? Yeah. You know, back in 15, when I started the company and we were building our product in 16, you know, I thought the rocket ship was going to take off, right? Like, you know, it really felt like there was kind of a very compelling piece of technology that nobody had ever seen before. We were seeing a lot of hardware companies investing like significant amounts of time and money and building new capabilities, new hardware. We were seeing exciting content. I was a little bit, I kind of like didn't really expect like what was involved with actually maturing this space and making it something that would be acceptable for consumers, kind of en masse. And so we took a product to market in 2016. We signed up hundreds of game developers. I think it was close to 500. And that was great, but these guys don't want to pay for Unity, let alone pay for analytics technology. And there was a long way to go before these folks were going to have a strong ecosystem that was going to be able to give them a livelihood that they would want to optimize. And so we started to spend time in enterprise. And really, enterprise has been a driving factor for us for like basically the majority of the company's lifetime. We've been spending, time on training and simulation, consumer research, academic research. We provide really good measurement outcomes for those types of use cases. But we pivoted over to enterprise. But now that we're getting to, I would say 2019 and beyond is where things started to change. You got into these all-in-one headsets and you removed like the friction of compute and the cost. And everything starts to get a little bit more streamlined. And we've got, tracking that's inside out and like all these different things that suddenly came to fruition. And things have really been kind of taking off since then. So now we're in the tens of millions of devices and we've got broad deployments and all the OEMs seem to be doing something. And obviously things are kind of looking a lot more mature than they did in say the earliest stages of this industry. And I honestly I came in a little bit late, like there was a lot of activity going on even pre-2015. And
Sure, sure.
I wasn't privy to either. So,
Right,
yeah.
right. Yeah, very interesting. So I mean, maybe looking forward, I do want to get into like what your perception of the future is near the end of the episode, of course, which is what I typically do. But like, do you see this trend continuing? I mean, obviously you do, otherwise I don't think you'd be in the space, but like with maybe perhaps Apple's Vision Pro kind of bringing about a newfound hype wave, if you will, bringing more attention back to the space, since I guess AI has been taking the dominant headlines over the last year or so. Do you see an acceleration of interest in the virtual reality and XR space in general?
Yeah, I mean, I've been waiting for Apple to do something in this category my entire career in this space, right? And so for them to put out a product means a lot. I think it means a lot to the industry in terms of like, kind of taking us forward and creating good competition and good, you said hype. I think that folks are just very excited about like what the possibilities are. I think that we're very lucky in that Apple produced a very high quality product that is arguably highly inaccessible, but is a good demo of what could be done and what high quality means. And I think that that's a very important kind of aspect. If they released a half-hearted product, something that, maybe reflected like, my best example would be back in, you remember Google Cardboard, like way back in the
Yes,
day, you could get
yes.
these little headsets, you put your phone in it,
Yeah.
and it just set like just the wrong impression for everyone. Of like what
Good
this
point.
technology is and what it could actually be. This is a different than the cardboard, obviously, right? And so if people are striving to be something like this, right, and this creates competition in the industry, it creates momentum at other OEMs to not be left behind. It creates new momentum with my customers, developers, the OEMs, the hardware platforms, the engines that support these things. So overall, I'm really excited about what Apple's created. I think there's work to do. It's very much kind of a dev kit that's somewhat inaccessible, but now we're going to start seeing it, go through its iterations and become something great.
That's a really good point. I guess the Quest, which is a more consumer-friendly device, though not nearly as I guess profound or as capable as the Vision Pro, brought a lot of interest to the space for like gamers, I would think, right? Like most people that were buying the Quest were more interested in gaming and I guess getting a little bit of a sense of what VR is capable of. But it's also interesting that you mentioned the enterprise solutions because that I haven't used the Apple Pro myself. I've obviously listened to a couple of reviews of it, but it seems like it's much more geared to enterprise solutions than it is consumer solutions, especially because of the price tag connected to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty. Really nice. I mean, it's a really incredible device. I think that there's definitely interest on the enterprise category on what Apple's doing. I think it's important to kind of note that not a lot of enterprises have Apple ecosystems, just from like a PC, perspective as well. So you kind of have to factor that in a little bit. Like, I'm an Apple user myself. You know, I've got the iPhone, I've got the watch, et cetera, et cetera. I'm wearing AirPods. When I logged into this thing, it kind of knew who I was. Like, it felt very personal. It had all my messages, my email came up, I got my calendar, like all the things just kind of made sense. And, you know, I was able to extend to my laptop really easily. It was clear to me that they hit on ecosystem. Like, it made a lot of sense. Mm. Does ecosystem really apply to enterprise use cases? Or are most folks living in the Apple world over an enterprise? I don't know. That's more of a kind of an open question. I also think that price point is already challenging. And I think that mobile phone prices are already challenging to enterprise when thinking about something like iPhones and iPads as well. So I think that $3,500, I think, gets us into building POCs and prototypes and, you know, building out the use case. I think they called it Apple Vision Pro for a reason as well. And, you know, maybe there'll be a vision, you know, like an Apple Vision, you know, at some point that's at a more accessible rate.
Very interesting. Yeah. That makes really good sense. Well, I'm glad I had you on. You're very knowledgeable on this space, obviously. Why don't we dive into a little bit more of the topics that we wanted to dive on, right? So education, learning, training. From the previous discussions that I've had with other experts, with other CEOs, et cetera, this seems to be one of the main use cases for virtual reality, apart from gaming, currently. Right. Yeah. There's tremendous benefits to it. Maybe you can remind myself, but also some of the listeners as to why that is.
Yeah, for sure. And you made a comment earlier about like maybe the Meta Quest is more of like a gaming console or like a gaming device or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could look at it like that, but I obviously look at it as, you know, it's a modality to consume content, right? Mm-hmm. And immersive content, that is, right? And I see a lot of different things going on. Like, you know, for some people, it's a gaming console. For some people, it's fitness. For some people, it's learning. It has a lot of different purposes. And it has a lot of great capabilities as well. Like, it's got tracked controllers. It's got high-quality pass-through, specifically the Quest 3, which is what I've been using recently. And really fantastic overall capability. And an accessible price point, which I think is really important for consumer adoption as well. And the modality, you know, in terms of like not, you know, requiring a PC, you know, or whatever to go along with it. On the learning side, huge category, right? Like, you know, you have an opportunity to train people through doing instead of watching, right? And if we think about like how people traditionally learn, you might watch somebody do an activity, be it, you know, in person, be it on a PC watching a video or a tablet. You know, or maybe even going through some slides, you know, very traditional modalities, classroom-based learning, those types of things. And I think what we found is that you have a really clear opportunity in enterprise to train people in a very consistent way, to make sure that it's a level playing field, it exists without bias, and you really have an opportunity to train by doing, building that muscle memory, building those reps. So when you go out and do that activity for real, it's natural. It's something that you've done before. Tactically, from a tactile perspective, you've actually done the steps. And so I think that that's one of the key differences that we see. And one of the most exciting parts of this is that enterprises see this as an opportunity to create enterprise-grade simulators for their business, right? Of like what they need to do, like what they need to train people to do. Mm-hmm. And this is a, you know, it's a really powerful technology. And where we fit in is really around the measurement side of that, like completion, compliance, and competence. Like, are you doing the work correctly, right? Are you ready to go out in the field? You know, like those types of things. And I think that that's an important aspect as well.
Right. One question I have for you. So you're mentioning, obviously, the tactile benefits of using VR within training. Are there maybe specific businesses or types of work that the training is more relevant for? I think I remember reading a couple of years ago, there was some, I can't remember if it was a Finnish company or certainly in the Scandinavian countries, where they had a large truck driving school that was using these headsets to train truck drivers because there was a a shortage of truck driver teachers, right? So they used a number of headsets to teach younger and up and coming truck drivers. So, you know, like driving one of these big semi trucks is not such a simple feat. There's lots of things to be done there. And that's a very tactile thing that you're learning. Are there other kind of specific applications or use cases when it comes to training that are more relevant than, say, like what I would be doing behind a computer, you know, learning project management or other things like that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it really comes down to the types of knowledge that you're trying to acquire. And mm-hmm. I also think the mode in which it's being delivered, right? I think that the use cases that make the most sense that people get really excited about is things that are really difficult to replicate, mm-hmm. right? So when we have risk to the employee in terms of injury, you know, inaccessibility of resource, that could be people, that could be equipment, it could be other types of scenarios, having to fly people to centralized locations, those types of things, inaccessibility of those scenarios, and things that include risk, you know, not just to people, but also equipment, you know, and other types of things as well, the public at large. And so I think that, you know, areas that are difficult to replicate and difficult to train on a consistent basis are some of the best use cases that I see. The other one that I see a huge impact is really just training at scale, right? Mm-hmm. If we think about like what it costs to actually train folks and do it in a consistent way on a human to human basis, VR really gives you a level playing field in terms of making sure that everybody's delivered the same knowledge, they're being evaluated the same way, and that that knowledge is being delivered on a consistent basis across your workforce. And when you've got, you know, facilities all across the country or employees all over the world, being able to maintain that standard level of training is something that is a huge problem for larger enterprises. And so I think that that's a kind of a key value proposition as well, is consistency in delivery.
For some of the people in the audience that might be thinking, well, okay, I can put on this headset and I can go through some sort of training simulator here. That's cool. That's fine. That's interesting. But I'm going to get so much more benefit, and my level of knowledge is going to be so much better if I actually have a human trainer in front of me and I go through some sort of little workshop or, I don't know, a week-long course or something like that. I've talked about this on this podcast before, so I'm playing a little bit of devil's advocate, but maybe you could talk about that, because I know that there's going to be some people that are thinking that.
Yeah, I mean, is that really true? I don't know if that's really true. I mean, the consistency is really a big question. Do you get trained on all the edge cases, on all the things that you could potentially encounter in working in your difficult scenario? I mean, think about it, right? Like, the DoD and the aerospace industry has been using simulators since forever, you know, I'm not going to try to date it, but it's been a while, right?
Yeah.
And being able to deliver expert knowledge, being able to have pilots in the cockpit that are able to encounter and have encountered every scenario you could possibly imagine, cabin depressurizations, hitting birds, you name it, right? Like all these different things, doors flying off. You know, I think that these are all, you know, really important things. And so, you know, being able to have the ability not to just train once and have that direct one-on-one time, but get in repetition with your ability to train and retrain and re-up your skill set is a really powerful thing. And being able to jump into a simulator that's not for an airplane, but is for the business that you work with, equipment that you're familiar with, and the work that needs to be completed, it's a self-serve opportunity for you to gain, you know, knowledge and skills.
Yeah. And I have to reiterate, I was playing devil's advocate. I've heard this.
No, it's all good. The thing I throw back to is like Matrix, you know, the original Matrix, where you're like plugging it in and, you know, going to download the helicopter program. This is our closest piece to that until we have Neuralink, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, that, I've touched on that before on the podcast, but that's a whole other topic, right?
Yeah. Roger that.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting. I even read a report, and I probably touched on it on the podcast a number of years ago. Like, there was only like 1 or 2 percentage points on an actual study that was testing people that were trained, and I can't remember the exact use case, but they were trained in VR versus trained in a workshop. The quality was only 1 or 2 percentage points, but in the workshop, as you mentioned so eloquently, the amount of costs and the amount of reiteration that you could do with a face-to-face workshop is very prohibitive versus putting on a headset again and running through
that again. Especially if the workshop is hands-on, you know, versus like just delivering material in a passive way. Yeah. I think that active training is obviously one of the best things that you can possibly do. There is a case study on our website that we did with Accenture, and it was kind of funny because, you know, I can't talk about like all the customers that we do work with, because we do work with a lot of enterprises, but the one we did with Accenture was funny because we did it with Accenture employees, and effectively we did kind of a two-sided, you know, kind of case study with them. On one side of the study, we had folks consume a YouTube video on how to install a toilet. Okay. And on the other side of the scenario, we built a toilet installing simulator in Unity that followed the exact same path, the exact same instructions, and had a bunch of people go through our toilet simulator. So we had one group go through the video, one group go through the toilet simulator. And we found that like folks that, you know, had done the work before, instead of watching the video, that I actually done the work in VR, were actually more effective in terms of like overall time. They completed the work with less errors, and, you know, they moved for the simulation much faster. So, I think that a lot of the results speak for themselves on learning via doing versus, you know, these passive methodologies. And so, I mean, yeah, a hands-on in-person workshop where somebody's standing over your shoulder, great way to train, not super scalable. VR can give you that at scale with hundreds of thousands of devices.
Yeah. And maybe to kind of put a cap on this idea, I mean, it just makes sense, right? If you're actively doing the task, right, as you, I think you mentioned, the muscle memory that you gain is, and if you do it many, many times, I mean, you're just going to be ready or more ready when it comes time to actually do that task in your real working environment than otherwise. So
Yeah. Well, the whole purpose of simulators in aerospace is to test pilots on things that they're most likely not in their career going to encounter.
Right. Okay. So then moving on, we have, I mean, one of the things that I guess is very valuable for the industry, but there might be also some kind of hesitation from people that are thinking about security and personal data, et cetera. It's all the tracking capabilities that are built into these fascinating technologies, right? So I've talked about biometrics, eye tracking is part of that. Can you touch on this and maybe explain how important it is for training, for the work that you do? I think that this is kind of a meaty chunk of the discussion that needs to be discussed a little bit more.
Yeah, for sure. So I think it might be helpful to kind of start with like, what does the product do and what its capabilities are. Mm-hmm. We collect a one-to-one replay of exactly what the user did and how they behaved. So we've got head position, rotation data, mm-hmm. what they're doing with their hands, how they're engaging inside of the environment, how they move through space, what objects they pick up, what they look at with their gaze. Mm-hmm. You can get specificity on things like eye tracking if the device is equipped. And you can even do biometrics in closed cases, right? So not consumer facing, but, you know, you might want to measure the cognitive load, the heart rate, galvanic skin response, respiration rates of a pilot that's dealing with like a cabin depressurization, you know, or something like that. Mm. So we take all of that data. We kind of, put it together into what we call an after action review. And so that's a one-to-one replay of what the user did, how they behaved. We then take all of those data streams and we can assess them. So we can assess them for behavior, how people are interacting in 3D space. This gives good value proposition to training and simulation, consumer research use cases. We have customers in academic research. And then we also have folks in consumer research. And I think you bring up a really good point. You know, data privacy is really important. I think that this data, this caliber of data, is unlike any computing modality before it, right? Mm-hmm. So we think about like web, we think about mobile. These are less personal, you know, in terms of slapping a computer on your face and being able to, you know, interact in a world with agency, you know, as a human, right? We're creating a new reality for someone, and then we're going to measure them how they're in that reality. I think in the enterprise sense, most consent is captured very explicitly. We're going to collect data on this experience. We're going to be assessing you. It's part of your work.
Yeah.
These are the things that we're going to do. I think that things like biometrics and eye tracking are a little bit overstated just in terms of the interest on the enterprise side. I think that there's definitely interest, and you know, we support this stuff. Like we can ingest eye tracking from a variety of headsets, mm-hmm. And we can make sense of that data. When we think about training and simulation, like is eye tracking, is being able to get that level of specificity versus just kind of like gaze and orientation data, is getting that level of specificity actually important for the simulation? I make the argument that a few use cases, yes, it is. If I'm going to evaluate law enforcement officers, I might want to make sure that they comprehend the world around them before they take action, right? Same thing goes with aircraft and pilots and things like that, right? Like when bad things happen on these things, we want to make sure that they refer to their checklist and that they've checked through the process of all the things that they should be looking at before they start taking action. And so those are types of situations where eye tracking might be beneficial. Same thing goes with biometrics, right? Biometrics is typically something we don't see at scale inside enterprises because number one, it's hard to deliver. Most headsets don't have biometrics at all, let alone eye tracking. And so closed environments, academic studies, those types of situations, we do see those types of capabilities. All the data that we collect on Cognitive 3D is inherently anonymous until our customer, be it a developer building a consumer application or an enterprise building a training application that wants to identify an employee, explicitly makes it an identified set of data to us. Once that data is identified, there's certain requirements in terms of data privacy and how we share. Cognitive 3D is not a business that is selling data or, aggregating data to sell to third parties or anything like that.
So the new Cambridge Analytica.
No, we're definitely not. No, we're providing a service for our customers, right? And the reality of it is that if we think about this type of content, the stakes are much higher in terms of delivering high quality experiences for developers. I can't kind of refer to you a iPhone app that I've put on my phone recently that has made me physically ill or made me want to put my phone back in the box and take it back to the store. And I think the stakes are high for not only developers that are building content, but platforms that are ultimately deploying content, that comfortable content that is of good performance and offers good immersive capabilities are actually really critical to building, great overall experiences. So I would make an argument that data analytics is actually more important in this category than any previous category. I think it's just really important that we don't use that data as a bad actor, And so for us, it's entirely focused on how do we empower the developer to make better decisions? How do we empower the enterprise to assess better the value that's coming off of these devices? And I think that that's how the way we look at it. But obviously, there's, broader, kind of impact that, if somebody is a bad actor and wanted to build a product that kind of takes advantage of that data, we need to be a little bit more careful about how we handle it. The last thing I'll mention on this one is we have built at Cognitive 3D something called the XR Privacy Framework. And so the XR Privacy Framework is a specific MIT licensed Unity and Unreal library. It pops up a consent window that will basically tell you, these are the types of data that the developer wants to collect for the following reason. And it acts as kind of like a do not track standard for the entire space. And so we've implemented it at Cognitive 3D. If you do send those signals to us, we will turn off data collection. So I think it's a good path forward. Do not track never picked up in mobile because there was no standard. So we ended up building it ourselves.
Okay, great. Yeah, and I guess the concept of opting in to being tracked is a lot more important than opting out, right? Because a lot of people might not, I mean, we're so used to so many di kind of accepting of policies now, right? It's just like people can skip over it and not realize that they have the opportunity to opt out, and they just skip it, and then their stuff is being tracked without really them being aware of it. So I guess this opting in idea is significantly better with that. Could you touch on, so you mentioned this after action review, and I think that's a really, really interesting idea because you have all of this data collected. But maybe before that, could you touch on the setup, maybe make it a little bit more tangible for some of the audience members and for me as well. Like, they're not just having a VR headset or an AR headset on their head. It sounds like there's a considerable amount of sensors and the like tracking a lot of other things. So maybe just paint a picture for that.
So not so much. I mean, basically, we offer a Unity and Unreal plugin, so you can just plug it into your game engine, your existing simulation that you're already building, and then we collect data from that simulation. So the developer has to implement it. It needs to be able to, we can't just track anything. So the developer has made a decision to collect data. They have either done XR privacy framework to get, you know, implicit consent from you, or they've disclosed via privacy policy or whatever it might be. That data then flows into the platform, and then they get access to the visualization tools to be able to kind of look at it. And it's not just at the after action review. I would make the argument at scale that after action review is not as helpful, because looking at one user to see what they did when you have 100,000 sessions is not super effective. So a lot of times we'll see folks spending a lot more time on the dashboards.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Then how about with all of this data that you have, how should I frame this question? The training that happens afterwards, right? Because I think one of the points here is improving the training scenarios that are done, that are created by these developers for these companies. Do you have any like use cases that you could talk about or examples where the training has been, improved after all of this data has been collected, and kind of what kind of benefits, these businesses have experienced?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the earliest days, it's about UX and UI and being able to understand how the content's being interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once we get past the baseline of testing a small group of people and getting some good insight on, you know, how we might want to move forward using tools like Scene Explorer, the after action review. The next step is then like, how do we measure at scale, and how do we start, you know, kind of evaluating these sessions and, you know, coming up with some valuable insights from it as well. And so we use a tool in our system called the Objective System. And what that allows you to do is set up either sequential or non-sequential criteria that are reflective of completion, compliance, and success. And each of these steps uses spatial data. So you can measure things like, where did the user go? What did they look at? What did they pick up? Did they demonstrate, you know, a fixation on a hazard within the environment before they took action? So you can set up kind of like these complex scenarios of being able to assess, like, are the users compliant with the things that we expected? And then provide that both on an individual outcome that you could push into maybe like a learning management system within the enterprise, or you could get, you know, take those aggregate insights and make better decisions about how you build the content or how you present, you know, the things that are being tested, evaluated, or shown. So typically we see folks use the objective system to kind of get to answers or answer to a hypothesis that they might have within the simulation. But the same tools can be used across a wide variety of use cases. So, you know, you can set up, for example, events that have timers on them to be able to measure how much time it took for a user to actually complete a task. And we could assess, like, are they getting better or worse, you know, in terms of how long they're taking within the environment, right? Like, are they getting quicker? You know, are they getting quicker without errors, which might be actually the more important piece, right? So it's like they're getting effective, but they're also not making errors. So yeah, you can use the tools in a lot of different ways. I can't speak specifically to use cases because I just don't do that. But like, those are the types of things I see.
Okay. And maybe, I don't know if it's going forward or going back into the discussion, but with the types of training use cases that are being used, and I know that you just talked about not being aware of the specifics here, but do you see, generally speaking, that these types of VR trainings, simulations are now starting to be used in new areas that haven't been used previously, especially with, I would say, that the growth of the amount of adoption of these tools, of these technologies has been growing over the last, say, decade or so. What was coming to my mind is, okay, well, maybe, you know, we were talking about military applications previously. That, like, there was a guest I had on that was talking about clearing landmines, for instance, right? Okay. So there's now this use case of training soldiers or specific technicians to clear landmines. Pretty difficult to do that in a real scenario, but in a VR scenario, it's you're able to train many, many times. Are we now starting to see more of these type of use cases in more areas, such as, I don't know, say like firefighters or you mentioned policemen, but is the amount or are the areas of VR training starting to propagate throughout society a little bit more than, say, the last couple of years?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, defense is not a category that we've seen a ton of activity at Cognitive, but there's certainly a lot going on.
Yeah.
And you know, that's kind of shown with the giant contract that Microsoft has with the HoloLens and like turning that into like a, you know, heads up display for For soldiers. But we're definitely seeing it spread out. And I think that the commonality, like you're talking about, like you asked me about firefighters, like, well, or this, well, mine clearing situation. Again, difficult to replicate scenario, difficult to present. How do you get reps on something like that when you can't, do it in a kind of a real scenario? So I think that those are kind of the overlaps that we see. But to be honest with you, like, it's across the board. I mean, often what we see even within an enterprise, it's not like obvious, it within an enterprise. Sometimes, you'll get a beachhead with a really specific use case within an enterprise, and then that use of technology propagates inside of the company to a wide variety of use cases and challenges that they had. And suddenly you go multimodal with that headset in terms of their ability to deliver multiple types of knowledge. And a good example would be like, okay, I'm going to do some hard skills training, maybe in logistics inside of a huge enterprise that has warehouses. I might also use that same headset to deliver forklift training. I might also use that same headset for other types of safety training. And then I also might use that headset for, soft skills training and interacting and doing, interacting with my coworkers, right? How to manage difficult situations. So there's lots of different ways that this technology suddenly is the answer for a lot of different scenarios that are difficult to replicate, but you can offer consistency across your workforce.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like maybe one of the challenges to increase the scale of adoption here is that there's just a lack of understanding or a lack of awareness of where this technology can actually be used for training scenarios. If these enterprises are thinking just one use case within the company, and then as they start using it, it's like, oh, well, we can use it here and here and here. It's just simply that they weren't aware of this stuff before, and there just needs to be a greater awareness of, well, one, the benefit, and two, the potential use cases within their own kind of training needs.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. And I also think that there's a bit of a challenge there in terms of like changing people's perception about what these things are. It's not a toy. It's not a game console. I'm not throwing an Xbox on somebody's head. And these headsets have the capacity to deliver value for big companies and enterprises, right? And so as soon as you kind of like break the go through the chasm there and kind of like move on beyond that thinking, you start thinking about it as like, we're not gamifying experience. We're not creating a game that is representative of your work. You're creating a serious simulation. You're creating a simulation of how we do business. And we're going to use that now professional simulator that we're only in the grasp of aerospace and defense and these types of categories. And now we're going to bring simulators into our enterprise.
Interesting. And maybe to connect it to the beginning of the podcast, do you think that the Apple Vision Pro, specifically with the Pro term, is that one of the steps, like the positive steps that might be facilitating this awareness that it's not just a gaming console, right? Because I think a lot of people who are, I guess, just outside of the awareness of what VR is capable of, they think, well, VR games, maybe some training, but mostly games, because I think that's how it's been certainly advertised with like the Quest, for instance, over the last couple of years. Do you think that now that there's a new technology in the environment that people are becoming more aware of, that this concept is starting to propagate around or through, I guess, society that, okay, VR is now a more professional tool than it was even considered a couple of years ago.
Yeah, we're getting another at bat here, in terms of another swing at being able to kind of take a run at the technology. And we kind of talked about at the beginning of the pod, that cardboard moment where we defined a line in the sand that was way down here, and Apple with the Vision Pro is setting the standard much higher. And so my expectation here is that lots of executives within these enterprises are going to get these devices. They're going to have Apple ecosystem. They're going to have a great experience in terms of what it is. And you start thinking about like, how could these simulations be used? How could I apply this to my business? Now, do I think that huge enterprises are going to go out and buy tens of thousands of these things at $3,500? Probably not. Like I don't think that that's super reasonable, but it's a good place to play, and figure out like where, what use cases would be really valuable and opportune for scale. I gotta point out though, like the Meta Quest 3 is like the best, like really great value, like incredible value, just in terms of like what it is, and for the price point that it's at, but the tracking, the pass through, the hand tracking, everything that goes along with it, That's a deployable headset, you know, that you could roll into your enterprise today and find huge value.
Interesting. Yeah, I was actually I was going to ask you about that because I still have the Quest One. I haven't upgraded mine.
Oh, you got to upgrade it. We're talking about
Yeah.
like a generational
Yeah,
change,
yeah, yeah. I was going to ask you
Mikey.
what exactly is the difference? Because I still like this thing. It's still like every time I go into VR, it's a fascinating experience. But
Yeah.
the I guess it's been 4 years, 4.5 years. So yeah, the difference is probably pretty monumental from version one to version
It's
three.
honestly massive. Like, I don't know if they're comparable. I think that on Quest One in particular, like that was the first, you know, kind of all-in-one with, you know, six DOF and inside out. Like, it made a lot of sense and it really demonstrated what could be done, you know, with the headset and got people excited about this idea that we're not going to be locked down to tethered devices and simulator rooms, and that these things could be deployed. They could be personal devices. They could be shared devices and, you know, break rooms and things like that. And then came along Quest 2. Then we had Quest Pro, which introduced higher end optics, better pass through, better hand tracking, kind of like new style hand controllers. And then we're moving to Quest 3, which takes it even a step further, where you know, even the pass through and the optics and all the things that, you know, kind of Quest Pro made exciting at a $1,500 price point, they had incorporated a lot of it into the Meta Quest 3. And so, yeah, I mean, you gotta go get one. I hope I sold you, but like, it's an incredible device. And the content library that you get access to is also significant as well. There's a lot of stuff you can do, and it's not just games. We're talking like fitness, productivity, you know, mindfulness, you name it. Yeah.
I'll have to check it out then. For your information, the first kind of 100 episodes of the podcast was really focused on the future of work. It's now shifted to kind of emerging technologies. But the future of work is near and dear to my heart. So if we can touch on that for a little bit, because I think this evolution of these specific tools, these specific technologies is fascinating, but I think it becomes more interesting when it's put into the context of the future of work. So, to, you know, go back a couple of years during the pandemic, there was a massive wave of interest and hype with virtual reality becoming the new way that we're all going to be communicating and interacting because the future is going to be remote, right? We're all going to be in our apartments, in our homes, et cetera, and the office is going to be a thing of the past. Didn't happen that way. There was certainly a year or two where a lot of people were using these technologies more. As the technology is getting better, do you see this future of work vision starting to come about, or will it come about? What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, we live it every day at Cognitive 3D. I mean, everybody on my team has a VR headset. We meet in stand up, so that's our morning meeting, at least twice a week in VR. So we use a variety of different productivity apps to do that. And you know, we see each other, you know, at least in from an XR perspective, a couple times a week, and then we also do social time as well on Fridays. And so we really live, you know, that kind of ideology because we are, you know, a completely remote team, and we're distributed all across Canada. And so VR has been one of those opportunities, you know, aside from, you know, doing an on-site, which is expensive, and getting everybody together, which we also do, it's been a great opportunity to kind of bridge that gap, you know, and spend time together within a more physical environment than just a Zoom call. Beyond that, we use, you know, video-based conferencing and those types of things as well. I think the future state in a lot of cases is really this idea of being able to deliver just in time knowledge, being able to make, you know, workers and folks that are working, you know, an ability to train and reskill as well really quickly, on, you know, as the world kind of evolves. You know, and there's always like this challenge of and balance that comes with like artificial intelligence and, you know, like what's going on in that category, and, you know, a concern around like what is it that people are going to do if a lot of these jobs get eliminated by AI? Well, you know, VR has a potential opportunity to help deliver, you know, some of that reskilling, retraining, just in time knowledge, things that maybe only humans can do. You know, as well. So I think that there's definitely a place for it, and I think that, you know, it's something that could also be, you know, kind of accelerated because of some of the things we're seeing in AI.
Really interesting. Yeah, maybe one other point on that. I think for people, and I'm sure there's a couple people that listen to the podcast that still haven't used VR. Could you, and I realize that our time is running out, but could you quickly touch on the immersive aspect of it? Like you guys use VR a couple times a week with a remote team. I'm sure there are some people thinking, ah, it's just like weird blocky avatars that are interacting, and it's not like you feel like you're next to somebody and you're still distant from your colleagues. Could you maybe correct some people's mindsets on that and maybe talk?
You gotta think about like being able to see everybody in a space together, the pose, the posture, what people are doing with their heads, what they're doing with their hands, mm-hmm. how they're engaging in that environment. It's very human, you know. It's very like the connectivity you get from something like that. You get a level of presence of feeling that other person in the room with you. You know, in some of the more sophisticated headsets, you've got things like eye tracking. You also have things like, you know, mouth and expression tracking as well. And so a couple of the folks on my team actually have the eye tracking headsets. So you can actually see them looking around the room and engaging with us, right? Yeah. And, you know, a number of my team members are, they all use custom avatars. Like some of them are pirates and, you know, sure. like those types of things as well. Sure. And other folks have just tried to make their avatars look like their likeness. And so that's what I do, for example. So yeah. I think it's, you know, we're not playing Roblox, you know, and it's, you know, we're trying to kind of like make ourselves look like we would at work. And some folks have made it a little bit fun. But the reality is that you get a shared connection with people, the best you can without being in the room. And I think that that's really what that's brought us as a remote team.
Yeah. 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 I would have to parrot that. That's certainly what I experienced when I was using it in the, during the COVID pandemic and the lockdowns. I remember going to my first conference in VR and I was still new to VR, very, very new to it. And there was a kind of a networking session after some of the speakers were speaking, and, you know, people were walking around, and I was talking to some guy from Australia and some guy from Thailand about the, you know, it was an XR conference, of course. And yep. You just get this weird, weird sensation that you're in front of somebody and you're actually talking to them, even though they look like, well, it was Quest 1, so a weird, blocky, cartoony character. But you still get that immersive aspect of like, oh, yeah. Well, you're across the world, but I'm still having an interaction with you. And because of that, we can connect on some level, much more than, you know, over Slack or over some sort of video conference.
Yeah. And you add a couple technologies to that, like eye tracking, spatial audio.
Yes. Right?
Like if you turn your head, like you can actually hear the voice shift, like just having those kind of very human things that we take advantage of every single day in the technology makes you feel much more connected with the people around you when you're in an immersive environment.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's very interesting, very cool, and looking forward. I also work with a remote team. We don't all have VR headsets yet, but maybe that's something I'll have to implement over the next.
Maybe you convince your team that that's something you need to do. I think it's very cool. You know, we have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. Very cool. Well, great, Tony. That's really interesting ideas. Is there anything else that you want to share? I missed a point here about. 3D insights and understanding the behavior of virtual scenarios, but I don't know if we want to dive into that.
I don't have too much to say on there. I think the biggest thing that I as a takeaway would just be, like, you know, the stakes for developers are much higher in terms of quality. We have a dashboard, it's freemium. Which means that most developers can use it for free for a long time. You know, it helps you surface as a barometer what makes good quality applications. So we look at things like comfort, presence, performance. So if you're interested in checking it out, cognitive3d.com is the place to go. I would also just kind of touch on the XR privacy framework one more time. You know, sure. If that is something that you're interested in, xrprivacyframework.org. It is an MIT licensed library. So if you're interested in contributing to it, please, please do. It's honestly hard to, you know, get folks to talk about it, listen, and, you know, maybe implement it. So if you're interested in checking that out, we're always looking for collaborators on that too.
Awesome. Well, that's a perfect segue into the very final point is, so I'll have those two websites up on the show notes. Are there any other places that you want people to follow you, reach out to you, see what you're up to?
Yeah, not too much. I mean, you can follow me on Twitter or LinkedIn. I do try to talk about spatial data quite a bit. So if you do follow me on LinkedIn, you'll find that I post kind of like graphics from our platform pretty often, and including like full replays and like visualizations and stuff like that. So if you're interested in the art of possible of like what can be done on 3D and spatial analytics, my LinkedIn, I've got lots of stuff there.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, I'll have all of that up on the show notes. And yeah, thanks again for coming on. And it's been a while since I've talked about VR and XR, so it's great to have you on to kind of
We got to get you
refresh.
the new headset, Mark. Let's
Yeah,
get it done.
for
Yeah.
sure, for sure.
Awesome.
Terrific. All right. Thanks a lot, Tony.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for listening to this week's Future Tech and Foresight podcast. If you like what you've heard here, there are, of course, a number of ways that you can support the podcast. The best way would be to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or give a rating on Spotify, which you can find a step-by-step explanation for on the futuretechandforesight.com website. Alternatively, feel free to leave a comment either on the episode show notes or the YouTube channel where you can see video recordings of the interviews. And finally, if you are part of an organization that is aware of the disruptive and transformational impact that emerging and future technologies will bring and want to know more, please get in touch to hear about the strategic foresight services that we offer and how we can help future-proof your organization and take advantage of the phenomenal opportunities available to survive and thrive in the future.
A lot of future shock people and future shock institutions in our society are simply overwhelmed.
Once there is superintelligence, the fate of humanity may depend on what the superintelligence does.
Science fact is catching up to science fiction.
The first truly intelligent machine will be the last invention that humanity needs to make.
The only scarcity that will exist in the future is that which we decide to create ourselves as humans.
Within a 10-year design revolution, we can have all humanity living the highest and living anybody's ever known.
Progress is accelerating at an exponential pace, and it's going to reach a point where progress is so fast, it's going to be a singularity.
We are probably one of the last generations of Homo sapiens.
Every single headline points to the birth pangs of a Type 1 civilization.